The Gordon Stanley at Owens Valley on 13th June 1974. Well, now, how did you get into radio astronomy and when?
You know, it's almost indefinite in my mind what the exact year was when I got in, but I had no professional interest in astronomy. My aim at that time was to complete college and go into electrical engineering, heavy electrical engineering of all things, as a matter of fact, not electronics and things like that. And the reason I ever even went to the lab was sort of the radio physics lab, that is, was an accident. It so happened that just at the end of the war, after I'd come home, there was one of my parents was very ill, and it was sort of necessary for me to find a job close to home.
I see.
So that I could look after her. And at that time, there were manpower controls in Sydney, and I was more or less directed to go to the lab because of my background. I really didn't choose to go.
That's interesting, but you didn't actually work on
radio. Mostly I worked as a technician, in fact, in the early days, in the first part of my study of radio physics.
But you didn't work on radio during the war, like Kerr and Pawsey did, I think.
No, I didn't. My background was, I was in training at that time, and in the war I was playing infantry. Then, I'm trying to think exactly how it started. It's not quite clear, and I wasn't in on the initial stages at the lab, but Pawsey had received some reports. I don't know, now I have to guess a little bit. There were a number of classified reports in the files at Radio Physics. There was the so-called Norfolk Island effect, which was...
What was that?
Well, I couldn't date the report, but it was during the war years, but the Norfolk Island effect was also the same effect that had been observed on the channel radar sets, where people actually saw they knew quite well if low-flying planes came in, they got interference patterns, and the Norfolk Island effect actually observed interference patterns from the sun, and then there were similar reports from some of the English channel radars. And also Bruce Lee, I believe, had written a letter to Pawsey describing the same thing.
I see, and this was the sea interferometer.
Yes.
I've never heard this. Oh, how interesting.
Oh, yes, this is the way it actually started, as a matter of fact. And then the first observations, this is actual fact, I don't think anybody will dispute me on this. The first observations were taken at a radar station near Sydney, not Dover Heights, but Coleroy. Fairly high elevation, I suppose, for 400 feet or so. And I think actually, now here I'm indefinite, I think the basis for the first publications, that is the Pawsey and Creedy Payne Scott paper, was based on the measurements taken with the Coleroy.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Station.
Yeah.
It was a mattress array. But then, for reasons I don't know, the Coleroy station was quite a number of the radar stations were closing down, the war was coming to an end. And we moved to Dover Heights for convenience.
Let me go back to these wartime reports. I hope I can find them in the files at CSIRO.
I forget what they were labeled. I saw some of them myself. I can't remember the titles. I think they were labeled just secret at that time.
Yeah. But was it recognized I guess it was recognized that the sun was the source, and...
It was, the statement was, I don't think it was recognized that the sun was the source. The statement was that in the direction of the sun, it was recognized there was a connection between the sun and whatever was happening.
I see.
But I think the inevitable conclusion was forged soon after. The basis of the Pawsey and the Creedy Payne Scott paper was that sunspots, of course, emitted the emission, and the thing was a fairly small diameter source on the sun. And actually, at the time, that paper, I don't know if you almost certainly heard this story, this is one of the slightly more scandalous ones, which I think you'd get some agreement on, was the paper was sent to Nature, you know, and when you get anything controversial in Nature, the policy has been to referee it. And the referee was Sir Edward Appleton. And so some weeks before the pausing the treaty, Painscott paper was apparently delayed, and Appleton sent in a paper beforehand, which in effect, I can't remember the whole gist of it, said that he had communications from amateurs back in 1930 or something like that.
Right, I know that, the little short communication, right.
Right, right. So that was a cause of some unhappiness, of course, but not too much, because Joe was a very generous man.
Well, there's a similar...
And Appleton visited Sydney, I think, sometime soon after that, and he was quite well received.
There's a similar story that Hay retells in his recent book about Martin's paper.
There's a lot of episodes like that in nature, actually. When I first came here, as a matter of fact, I never had any personal experience with it, but I felt that we were starting an American observatory. And the tradition was that if you had any short, quick publication, you sent them into Nature. And I said, no, I should send them to an American journal, because I didn't think that Nature's policy was completely unbiased. It seemed to me they picked these individual papers to referee, and then you never knew quite.
And so, as Australians, you felt somewhat discriminated against.
Yeah, well, I wasn't directly involved at this time. I was sort of somewhat on the lower echelon, hearing rumors from above. Now, I really, the time scales get a little bit mixed here. I started to get involved out of Dover Heights. That was my first contact. The Colleroy Project had visited and finished. To my knowledge, I never really visited Colleroy. Dover Heights was my baby, mainly on a technical scale at first. And there were a number of, well, some of these solar things definitely came last. I can't clearly recall exactly what part of the solar project I was involved in at that time. Where I distinctly recall the events were of course, the Cygnus size discovery.
Right.
And that, of course, we had, of course, Hay, Parsons and Phillips, the paper was published, and of course, some excitement, as I'm sure it did everywhere else. And MacCready, I think the person who sort of initiated any effort at the lab was D.F. Martin. It's possibly not recognized, but D.F. Martin had seen it and said, well, why don't you try and look at it and see if you can see anything with the cedar from it. Well, MacCready and Yardley set up some old receivers. We had a lot of these so-called old gun-laying radars, which worked about 75 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
And MacCready and Yardley actually went out and spent a lot of time looking for interference patterns at Dover, and couldn't find anything and gave up in disgust. I don't know quite why it was written off, whether they thought that Hay was wrong or what it was.
Hmm.
But they did give up.
That's not in the published record anywhere, is it?
No, it's not in the published record, but they did try. And at that stage, I was left all on my lonesome out of Dover. I did not have any part of that MacCready-Yardley experiment, so I just decided to fool around by myself and start looking. And I got the first interference patterns from Cygnus. Now it was immediately recognized that we were sort of onto something big, and it was decided to assign somebody else with me to sort of carry it through. And John Bolton, who was just out of the Navy, was then assigned to come in to Dover Heights. And it was a very close relationship between John and myself at that time. So we nailed down the Cygnus thing. There's lots of little episodes, I think, because of course in those days the equipment was very cranky, and you'd get interference patterns one day and you wouldn't get them the next, and the equipment would fail. It's sort of amazing to look back on it. And the sea interferometer had quite a lot of nasty habits, like you could get interference wiped out by refraction problems, and you could get sources rising 10 minutes of time late and all this sort of crazy stuff.
You mean because of differential atmospheric conditions?
Sure. The first five sources, first four or five sources, Virgo, Centaurus, Taurus, four sources actually, It was sort of friendly competition between John and myself. I think if anything, I probably John got the first patents on Virgo. I got the first patents on Taurus, and it was always friendly competition in the way that we'd say, you didn't, there's nothing on your record and there's something on mine, sort of.
Right. This was just taking turns observing the equipment, basically.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Well, before I lose track, I think that's a good point to stop. And you want to sort of quiz me from here rather than let me ramble on.
Well, I just didn't let you ramble on. I find this format the most useful in general. But let me specifically ask here now, that there was the paper of you and Bolton on Cygnus alone.
Yeah.
And then there was the paper of the three identifications with you and Bolton and Slee, I think, right?
Yeah.
And then also there was a separate paper by Bolton alone in which he had several sources, I think half a dozen, though the positions were off quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen references that was just a matter of he had the refraction corrections wrong somehow, but was that really just a blunder? It would seem like he understood all that.
Oh, no, there was one amazing mistake, which actually was corrected. There was no mistakes in Labour papers, but there was a mistake in the Cygnus paper, which I don't think was put in, and you may have heard the story after the fact. That is, we actually took he made the correction. It was actually picked up by Arthur Heeks, who was a very sharp guy. I mean, although Arthur's name doesn't appear on many papers, he was one of the most valuable men at radio physics. He had the art, I think, of reading a paper critically.
Mm-hmm.
At least in an intelligent fashion. Too many people will read a paper and look for something to criticize one point without seeing the forest of the whole paper. Well, the funny thing was, the Cygnus paper had been read by just about every prominent astronomer that we could find in Australia, you know, and it was missed. The simple fact was that, not knowing anything about astronomy, we'd forgotten completely about precession. And so
I see.
So,
but
at that time we hadn't precessed from 1900 coordinates to 1947, so it was quite a big error. Now, the errors in the other paper were just bad measurements and problems of the C interferometer and things like that. There was no identifications coming out of things. I mean, even to illustrate how hard it was to identify things, Taurus A was not identified until we went to New Zealand. Now, Taurus should be the easiest thing to identify, a thing which is roughly 7 arc minutes in diameter.
Which was a well-known, astronomically well-known source.
Sure. But we had to sort of get different baselines. The difficulty of the C interferometer was being stuck with one baseline and observing one wavelength. And then the refraction correction, and Tom Piercy had been a lot of work being done on super refraction at the lab. It was a wartime project because of this waveguide effect in radars. And so we knew quite a lot about what to expect in the way of refraction, but it was very, very difficult to predict it from day to day, plus the fact you had ionospheric effects of fouling the thing up as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I forget the actual accuracies you could expect out of those early records, but it has to be in excess of 10 arc minutes, and that really was not enough to really identify anything. There was nothing really forgotten in the corrections we applied to the records. But we got better records in New Zealand. We had less atmospheric, we had a different baseline and things like that in the Taurus, and I think also the Taurus identification clearly came out of the New Zealand records. But see, even as late as the stage when we came to the United States in 1955, the identification game had not progressed very fast. In fact, I was just saying to somebody the other night, when with Bernie Burke, as a matter of fact, this interferometer here was designed before the synthesis ideas had been proposed, and we were still working on our basic concept of how to get some idea about the diameters. The earliest concept was, okay, you take baselines, and then you multiply them by integral numbers, and this gives you some idea about what the diameter of the source is. We've gone to nothing more refined than that. And Bernie said, well, I was making too much of a point of this, that really it wasn't a bad approximation to synthesis, and in truth it's not, but the mental concept from there to the full synthesis is quite a big step, and Rav was a giant step forward, of course. The other thing about it was that the literature at that time, here was John proposing that for the Navy that we could get precision accuracies of half an arc minute, whereas nothing was in the literature, in the technical literature, which said that you could do very much better than 10 arc minutes. True, I think Cygnus had been measured at that time.
Well, Graham Smith had done
right. Right, but it was a very strong source, of course.
And Cass, he'd done that well,
right,
too.
But a lot of effort went into it on a very strong source. But the really big breakthrough in radio astronomy, you wanted 100 sources like this, and there was nothing in the numbers which said you could easily do it.
Right.
I mean, it was very easy to say, yes, I could do it on Cygnus and Cass, but not on the other.
It wasn't clear. There was just a sensitivity question. I mean, if you got...
Well, there are a lot of papers... not readily available, a lot of information theory papers. A friend of mine, Bob Price, who worked with me on deuterium, had a lot of background in that, and he supplied me with papers which had looked at this numbers games and what the sensitivity angular accuracy relationship looked like, and it didn't look hopeful in those days in terms of what receivers we had.
I see. So it wasn't thought of as being a fundamental problem, but just a matter of what was technically feasible.
Yes.
Well, let's go back. We're getting skipping ahead a little too fast for my liking anyway. First of all, the position that you put in the Cygnus paper was the precess correctly, finally, the published version.
I think so.
I think it must be okay, or else I would have noticed that.
Pretty well done, certain it was. It was picked up before the thing was published, right. And the man who picked it up was Arthur Heaps. But it went a long way before it was picked up. That paper kicked around all over the place.
Yeah. And the Bolton positions, then, you're saying, were not only a matter of not applying a correction properly, but just something wrong with the actual observations that we've seen also.
Yeah, I wouldn't place too much stress on anything like that, because you have to remember, put yourself back in the frame of 1947-48, we have no knowledge of astronomy at all. I mean, you've got very little concept of how ignorant we were. There was nobody in the lab whatsoever, really.
Apparently it was
one of the first jobs that John had, one of the big things, because the sun was such a big deal at the lab. I think several people, so I think both John and Paul had this job, was translating Goldemeyer from the German.
I see.
And this was our first education in the sun.
This was about what?
And
about
Gamow's book, too, is very popular, The Birth and Death of the Sun, of course, and that's largely our education in astronomy, our early education in astronomy.
When was this translation undertaken? That book didn't come out until the late... Or when did that come out?
Well, I don't know when the book came out, but I know when they were doing it. It had to be 1946 or something like that.
Oh, it was just after the war.
Yeah. 47. No, it had to be 46, 47, one of those 2 years.
I've also been...
It was never finished, the translation. I don't know, there's translations about never. Our translation was never finished.
I've also heard that there was some contact, I can't remember the fellow's name, at Sydney Observatory or something like this.
Wood.
Right.
Hollywood. Hollywood was one of the people who read the Cygnus paper.
Who came over and kibbutzed stuff from the astronomical point of view.
You didn't have much contact, really. We did talk to Hollywood, yes. But I was never very conscious that he was about. I would say D.F. Martin was our closest link. We were largely a bunch of engineers, you know. So.
Is Martin still alive?
No, he's dead. He died about 2 years ago, unfortunately.
Well, okay, so...
suicide, as a matter of fact.
So we have this development in these first few years where you're getting into more and more... astronomy and more technical engineering, and beginning to identify a few of these radio sources and so forth. And I assume that there was a strong rivalry with the Cambridge group going on at this time.
Oh, yes, and I think it was more on those. There was quite a bit of rivalry, as a matter of fact. It sort of the first part of the rivalry started between between John and myself and Martin. Although it didn't go on very far, the essence of the argument was Martin is a great man and a beautiful person, but he's slightly paranoid, I'm afraid. I think his later history has shown that. But as I remember it, the sort of argument was who discovered what first. Sort of, I discovered Cassie, and it was that sort of thing. It was sort of nonsense. It was so trivial. I really can't remember the details, but it got Martin very upset, you know. And the way we were doing things were wrong, the way he was doing things were right. But the more serious argument occurred between he and Mills. And Bernie had been on a project. Bernie didn't come in till quite late. And when he'd been on a project to construct a linear accelerator, this was a byproduct of our interests in waveguide techniques and things like that. Well, anyhow, he got very sick while he was on the project. He developed TB and he had to go off, I forget for how long, a year or something like that. And when he came back, Prozzi, we were pretty well along.
What time now?
We were talking about 47, 48. Things were pretty well along, and Dover was, it was quite a big thing. It was an exciting thing. I'm digressing a little bit here, but it's almost impossible. It's the one thing I could never capture in this game. I mean, the excitement of the whole darn thing at that time, and yet it doesn't seem that significant looking back. But it was so unique, so exciting to be in on it. I mean, so many things have gone on here, for example, which probably are more important and more sophisticated and require a much greater depth of perception and things like that. But never once have I recaptured anything like the excitement of those first few years.
But it was starting a whole new science. I mean,
that's right. It was the start of a whole new science. And I didn't think very profoundly about it. It was just simply exciting. It was simply great fun.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful feeling. And it would be nice to be able to be in something, be it whatever it is, to be able to recapture that sort of thing. Anyhow, I'm digressing about Bernie. But Bernie came back to the lab about 48, and Joe at that time suggested he come out and work with us, because Joe, of course, could see what was happening was very important, and Bernie was probably the most competent guy technically at that time in the lab. And Bernie sort of himself said, well, no, he sort of preferred to do his own thing, and started to think about east-west interferometers, simple interferometers. Well, you'd have to talk to Bernie to get all the time sequence in this, and I'm lost a little bit, but I was going to talk about the relationship with Ra, which I do know about. Bernie was a fair way along, and he was working with another guy, a Welshman, who later went back to England, whose name escaped me, whose name is on some papers, I know that, from the early papers with Mills. And they were having reasonable success, things were sort of going slowly. Anyhow, a chemist came through. I think the guy was a chemist from Cambridge. And at that time, we used to have colloquia in the tower room on the National Standards Lab side of the CSIRO building in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't matter what the subject was. It was a good excuse to take an afternoon off, and just about everybody in both labs would go along if they were feeling a bit lazy. So we went along, and I know Bernie was there, and at the end of the lecture, Bernie asked him if he knew anything about what Martin was doing at Cambridge, and the man said, well, he really wasn't privy. Martin even then was still secretive like he is now. He said, but he had some idea. They had some sort of phase switching arrangement, and I'm not sure that was his exact words, but I was there at the meeting and it was something like that. He said, well, Bernie went away with his other friend and they figured out what was going on, the load switching technique. And so they built their own load switching array, which was very successful. The upshot of that was a sort of unpleasant letter from Martin, which I did see parts of. I can't vouch for the words again. You'd have to ask Bernie what right had had Mills use his idea. He had a patent on it. That was the tone of the letter. You couldn't do that sort of thing, and that was the start of the rather bitter relationship between Martin and Bernie.
This is long before the 2C controversy and so forth. This is late 40s, or?
Yeah, it's the late 40s still. So it's the other controversy. I was privy to the whole of the other controversy because that started it started a peak about 1958 in Paris. Of course, that's when it got quite a... I was sitting there behind Martin while he was sort of trying to answer Bernie. And then, of course, in Berkeley again, it was interesting because they had that fight at the Invited Discourse, and I, that night, took Martin, myself and my wife, to Martin and his wife out to dinner immediately after, although he'd gotten out of it by that time.
But now, if this is the late 40s, Mills didn't publish his...
My time scale is hazy here, but still, go ahead.
But he didn't publish his paper describing his cross until 52.
Well, this wasn't the cross. This was the...
This was just the principle.
This was load switching. This was the load switching, the business of getting rid of the sky. To my knowledge, I know there's something being said about the origin of the cross, but I can't recall that there was any correspondence between Martin on it, but I think that was after the fact, really, if there was anything. I think somebody suggested that the idea of the cross is embedded in one of Martin's papers.
I've heard that said.
But that was not the start of the fight. I don't think Martin, by that time, Martin was pretty bitterly opposed to Bernie. It was over the load switching that she was opposed, not the cross.
I see. Right, okay, so... we're up to the point in 48 or 49 when a few sources have been identified. And what was the next step after that point?
Well, things actually dragged, you know. It really wasn't, as I said, till we came here that the identification game moved. And there was, in the period between 50 and 55, which is when I came to the United States, there started the controversy about rays and large and telescopes, which was to tear the lab apart, of course, finally.
Single dishes, right. Versus the rays, yeah.
And I felt myself that the day of the C interferometer was done. That sure, we can do a lot of things for it. John wasn't convinced, and John... There were two projects competing in the lab at that time. John wanted to build a very large cylindrical parabola on the cliff edge, just to get more and more collecting area, again, to fight this numbers game that I was referring to earlier. And Bernie at this time was starting to propose the Mills Cross. We're starting to get into the period 51, 52, that sort of order then. I told John that I really wasn't behind him on this. And the upshot of it was that the Mills Cross went out. Joe said, well, we'll go with the Mills Cross. And, we started to look around for another idea, and Kevin Westfold was in the group at this time, and we came up with the 90-foot parabola dug in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that was proceeded with. Well, John was searching around for another idea. I mean, he was at last convinced that that the east, west, or north, south interferometer was the way to go, and so he and I talked about it, the technical feasibility and things like that, and we decided on some combination of the configuration of cylindrical paraboloids, again movable on tracks, the sort of thing we have here. So I started site searching for this, because the lab was made up. Joe was sort of very gentle guy, and he didn't sort of try and come down on people and say, no, don't do this, no, don't do that. There were a lot of people going in different directions, and a lot of duplication, a lot of very wasteful duplication for a place that size.
Well, I've heard.
So I went up and down the coast scene and located the site. Now, where the blow-up occurred, I don't know. This was, at that time, Paul was also looking for a site, Paul Wild, and I was helping Paul. This was how the Dapto site was originally picked. On the trip that John Murray and myself and Steve Smurd and Paul.
I see.
And there's some wonderful stories about that trip which don't necessarily appear in a book like that, but still. We went all the way down to a place called Bermagui and then came back up the coast, and I picked on an area near Jervis Bay to build the interferometer. and Paul picked the dapto, so. Well, this was the second, John wanted to force a